Mahoney, who's joining you from EPA's Technology Innovation in Field Services Division to officially start today's session. Michelle?
Okay, great. Thank you, Jean, very much. I appreciate the introduction. So today, as Jean mentioned, we'll be presenting a webinar on our mining webinar series that we've been doing on CLUIN for quite a few years now. And I just wanted to make sure everyone was aware of the focus area on mining and mining treatment technologies and other case studies that we have available at CLUIN.org. You have the web link right here, and this is just a picture of what the main page looks like. So I encourage you to visit that, and we also have links to all of the archive presentations that we've done over the years. And as I mentioned, today is part of a series. This is the specific link that you can go to view the other webinar archives that we have available based on our previous presentations. So if you would like to learn about other sites or other types of treatment being done at mining sites, I would encourage you to check that out. And with that, I think I would like to introduce Jeff Crowley, who is the remedial project manager for the site that we're going to hear about today. And he's going to give a little bit of an introduction of the site and the speakers that we have today.
So, Jeff, now is a great time.
Thank
to
you. I'm here. Yeah. I'm trying to advance the slides. There we go. All right. Thank you all for coming today. Again, thank you. My name is Jeff Crowley. I am a media project manager with the EPA in Region 4 based out of Atlanta. Today we're just going to talk about the Henry's Knob Superfund alternative site. So this is a site that is not currently on the MPL, nor will it be on the MPL. It's under the Superfund alternative program, which had a lot of prominence about 10 years ago. It basically, when we have a willing, responsible party willing to do the work, we try to let them do the work as much as they can with our oversight, and thus keeping the site off the MPL. However, the site must follow the same format as the MPL. So we'll have an RI. It's already had a remedial investigation. We're going into the feasibility study here in a little while. So that's one other thing I want to say. All this work that you're going to see today has been done after the remedial investigation under some interim measures that we were able to do to prevent some of these tailings issues from becoming, continuing to be a long-term problem. So the site is located in, sure, I'm sure we're going to get into this in a minute, but the site is located in a town called Clover, South Carolina. It's kind of about, you know, 45 minutes to an hour southwest of Charlotte, North Carolina, if you're familiar with who that is. It's a former kyanite mine. And again, in the southeast, we don't have that many mines. You know, we do have our fair share, a good handful of them. But, you know, whenever we do get one in the southeast, they present some specific challenges due to the amount of rainfall and things that we get down here in the southeast. And so today, I wanted to turn this over to some of the crew that's been instrumental in developing this technology that we've put on the site of these tailings, how to mitigate the problems from those tailings. So on the phone with me today, I have Eugene Shepherd, Paul Johnstone, and Jason Provencher with A. McFoster Wheeler, who are the contractor that the responsible party is using for all of their engineering and cleanup work. So right there on that link, this site also has a pretty extensive case study that goes along with what we're talking about today. If you just want to click on that link, and you can go download that right now. It's publicly available, and get some more of the background information and some links. And again, if you have any questions for me, feel free to chime in today, and I'll do my best to answer them from the regulator side. So with that, I'll turn it over to Eugene Shepherd.
Thanks, Jeff. Good afternoon, good morning, folks. I'm Gene Shepherd with AMEC Foster Wheeler. I am the project manager for the Henry Knob remediation work. I work closely with both Paul and Jason over the past probably 10, 12 years to complete the RI on the site, do the interim measures, and we're just getting ready to roll into the feasibility study phase for the site. So the Henry Knob former mine site, here's a couple of photos that are kind of post-remedy so far. We've done a bunch of work there that we're going to talk about today and discuss, and we'll go through and talk about some of the other investigations and studies we've done to support the interim measures we've conducted. Just to break down what the presentation is going to look like, I'm going to give a little bit of information on the background and site history. Then Paul Johnstone is going to talk about the remedial investigation and some of the groundwater and groundwater monitoring programs and groundwater modeling programs we've done. And then Jason Preventure will roll into the vegetative test plot studies and some of the remedial measures we've done at the various areas of concern at the site. And to date, we've dealt mostly with the tailings impoundments for the for this topic. We're going to cover work that's been done on the tailings impoundments to stabilize and stabilize those and get the vegetative cover established on those impoundments. Site figure and location. I think as Jeff said, the site's a former kyanite mine. It's located about 45 minutes southwest of Charlotte, North Carolina. It's near the town of Clover, South Carolina. Clover's becoming a bedroom community to Charlotte, and the development of Clover is beginning to push out west and south towards the mine site. The figure that's shown on the slide here is an image from Google Earth, and it was taken in the spring of 2017, and it gives a good overview of some of the different stages of work that were in progress at that time frame that we've since completed. Hopefully you can see the cursor on the slide deck. This is one of the former tailings impoundments. The work had been completed there in the spring of 2016 or fall of 2016. Oh, there it is. Thank you. This is one of the tailings impoundments that we did work on first. As you can see, it's been revegetated. This structure here is a terminal dam that was built for the containment of the impoundments. This is an area of concern, too, that we're going to talk about a little bit later as well. This was an in-progress picture. Again, another tailings impoundment dam that was here. And then this was the final area that we worked on, area of concern 5, and no work had been done on that. And it's kind of hard to see, but there's also a small tailings impoundment that's right here that had also been revegetated prior to this photo being taken. Just some basic history and background on the site. Again, the site's located near the town of Clover. It's about 185 acres in size. From 1947 to 1970, a company called Commercial Ores operated an open-pit kyanite mine at the site. Kyanite's an aluminum silicon oxide that's used in the manufacture of high aluminum brick and other refractory materials. The deposit's one of several in the mineralized zone in the Kings Mountain Belt, which is a highly enriched area. And Paul will talk a little bit about the geology in his discussions about some of the geological features that were mined in that area. As part of the RI, which Paul's going to give a little information on, we identified 10 areas of concern. The ones we're going to deal with and in the discussions today are the tailings ponds and revegetation and rehabilitation of those impoundments. The first is AOC-1. AOC-1 was the west tailing pond, AOC-2 the north tailing pond, AOC-3, which was the former mine operations building and was also used as a pyrite storage area, and then AOC-5, which is the east tailings pond. Little information on the ownership and history of the site. So the site, again, was started the mining development in the early, mid-1940s and continued on until about 1970. It was owned by a company called Commercial Ores that was, that had various sister companies that operated the mining operations there until the 1970s. In 1970, the company of Commercial Ores was purchased by a private company, and then later on that private company was purchased by our client who is responsible for the work at the site, who is the PRP that's conducted the work. Little bit more on time frame. As you can see on the timeline, there are some private owners that had taken ownership of the mine from the time Commercial Ores shut down the mining operation until the time when our client took over the work at the site. The county, York County in South Carolina, was a landowner for a while, and there were a couple other private landowners as well as a couple other commercial landowners that transferred the property back and forth throughout the next 10 or 15 years. a little bit more on the timeline, these last couple entries here. In order to facilitate some of the remediation at the site, our client had to purchase some properties to gain access and control over materials that we were going to have to address as part of the RI and the FS. And these two pictures in the upper portion of the slide show you the difference in property boundaries as the client acquired the property. Developmental history. This was a great resource for us to try to figure out how the site was developed throughout the years. These are some Sanborn aerial photos that we were able to procure and help us understand how the site was developed. 1941, undeveloped area, the Henry Knob, you know, the hills, the knob is still intact. As you can see, as time progresses into 1949, the first development has taken place. You can see the inroads to the mine pit, where the mine pit will be located, start to develop. In 1954, the mine pit is easily observed from an aerial photo. There's access roads. Mining operations were here, and tailing areas and tailing raceways were starting to form in this area here. And again, kyanite mining, it's an open-top mine, so the first development was to get rid of the overburden on top of the knob, on top of the ore deposit. That material was scraped off, and then the waste rock was deposited on the flanks of the pit and on the flanks of the flanks of the knob. As time progressed, the pit formed, and you can see some in the 1959 photo, the pits forming large areas of waste rock that are being generated and placed around the pit. Again, the mining and mine processing operations here and some tailings areas are starting to form. The operation for mining kyanite is basically they take the ore body, they take the overburden off the top, blast out the rock, pulverize the rock, and then slurry the rock. And the kyanite in the slurry floats to the top. They skim the kyanite off, and then the tailings and the rest of the waste rock goes out the back end as waste material and is contained in these tailings impoundments and allowed to dewater. And you can see in the 1964 photo, large tailing impoundment starting to form here. This is AOC-1. This is going to be AOC-2 over here. And again, the mine pit's enlarged. There's actually now two large veins that have been mined out. And then 1970 is the end of the mining operations. Again, you can see the mine pit here, tailings area here. This is AOC-1. This is AOC-5, Area of Concern 5, another tailings impoundment, Area of Concern 2. And then this is Area of Concern 3, which is the former historical operations and the pyrite storage areas. And interesting about the site location is one thing to point out which is an important features is this road here is State Highway 55 and this road here is Henry Knob Road. Both are this is a state-owned road, this is a county-owned road, and both those roads had impacts from erosion and tailings transfer from the mine property onto the roadways, which was one of the precursors that led our client to really kind of focus in on this site and try to come up with some remedial strategies to address the ongoing erosion and transfer of mine tailings down slope to the lower elevations. In 1981, just another historical photo, as you can see, the area is pretty denuded of vegetation, not much coverage on any of the tailings areas. And then from 1981 to the 2012 photo, you can see that there is some revegetation that's naturally starting to take place in and around the mine pit. We've got a lot of pine growth that's coming in. Some of the historical operations areas have pine growth and grasses that are starting to come in. The AOC-2 tailings impoundment has significant tree growth, mostly pines and some hardwoods are starting to come in. And the southern end of AOC-1 is starting to get some growth right here. And one of the things that's interesting, and I think if you can see the color differential on the aerial photo, you'll notice that this area, which is Area of Concern 5, is bright white. And that was mostly a silica sand area. There's not much vegetation growing there. no organic content in the material. And then as you go downslope from the mine and across Henry Knob Road, and then downslope in AOC 1, you notice the coloration changes to a darker brown or a little bit browner tan. That's the silt and the fines that have washed down into that area, and you can see that the silt and fines are starting to hold some moisture in that are allowing some of the tree growth to take place. Just an aerial view of some client-owned property and a couple key features that I'd like to point out. These are the areas that we'll be talking about. AOC-1 is this large tailing impoundment right here. There's an intermediate dam right here that was breached to form that broke AOC-1 into AOC-1 north and south, and then a terminal dam here which kept the impoundments from going down into the stream valley, which headwaters right here. AOC-2 is up in the center portion of the photo. Again, that was one of the older tailings areas, and it looks, as you can see from the aerial photo, there's some vegetation that had naturally occurring vegetation that had started to take place there. AOC-1 is another large tailing impoundment right here. Massive erosion at this AOC. This area of concern one is located. I'm sorry, area of concern 5 is located on the flanks of the hill, and quite a bit of erosion there just from natural transport processes, the rainwater and the stormwater flowing downhill. And again, one of the other AOCs, AOC-3, is over here, and that's the former pyrite storage area. So the client-owned property is shaded in this red shading, and the privately owned piece is this road right here, which extends up the ridgeline of the knob up to the top of the knob. And there are two private residences located on the top of the knob as well as a commercial cell phone tower. So those were some of the hurdles that we had to work around while trying to do this work, and we continue to work around while trying to finish up the work that we're doing there. So just one thing to keep in mind is that we had some landowners that we had to deal with. And part of the reason why ABB, why the client secured the property, was so that the remediation could take place without any limitations placed on it by the privately held landowners. A little bit of regulatory history. I think Jeff's talked a little bit in his introduction about some of the RI process. In the investigation for the site started in about 2000 with a pre-surplus site screening that was conducted by South Carolina DHEC. And that took place in 2000-2001 time frame. And from that initial investigation, they identified some elevated metals in site soils and groundwater that they wanted to look at further. It rolled into a limited preliminary assessment site investigation in January of 2002. And then from that, in 2004, EPA issued an administrative order on consent to our client to complete an RIFS for the site. That was basically the order that that ordered our client to take financial responsibility for the remediation of the Henry Knob site. That order included performance of a remedial investigation and feasibility study, and we'll talk a little bit about that order in a minute on a slide in the next couple slides. But what that order stated was that ABB was responsible for investigating and remediating the Henry Knob site to make sure that the mine closure was properly conducted. From 2005 to 2010, we conducted the remedial investigation, and Paul's going to talk a little bit about that in his part of the presentation. And then from 2011 to 2013, we finalized the remedial investigation report. We conducted some groundwater ECA, an engineering evaluation, and a cost analysis to address some groundwater contamination. The residents in the area had some impacts to their potable well water that we had to take care of. And then in 2013 is when we really kind of embraced the adaptive management approach and developed that with concurrence from EPA and South Carolina DHEC to move forward with remedial strategies for the site. In 2014, we started some pilot studies and design and construction of the remedies that we're going to talk about today. Those remedies were done as interim corrective measures, and they took from about the beginning of 2014 until December of 2017 to do the pilot studies, do the design, and the construction for remedies at the four AOCs that we'll discuss today. So what got the site started towards revitalization? As I said earlier, there was massive erosion, large-scale erosion that was ongoing at the site that had been an issue in the community for a couple different reasons. One was just it was an eyesore. The site was denuded of vegetation. It couldn't support any substantial growth. There were some community concerns about people accessing the site for recreation. There were four-wheelers and dirt bikes that used the site for recreation, and that was both a safety concern for our client and an issue for the landowner that at the time that owned most of the property. There were breaches in some of the dam impoundments, and you can see this in some of the figures. This is one of the impoundment dams, and this is Henry Knob Road right here. You can see there's a breach in the impoundment dam. This is the area of concern 3. This drainage channel, this erosion channel, led right out to Highway 55. And then this is a landscape picture of AOC 5. And as you can see, there's just massive erosional rills present on the site. Some vegetation is starting to take place. But I think the one thing you can't see that this scrub growth is hiding is the erosion rill in that area was probably 15 to 20 feet deep and maybe 5 to 10 feet wide. So there was quite a bit of transport of the tailings from the slopes and the flanks of the knob down gradient to towards the roadways, towards some of the private residences, and into the AOC 1 impoundment, which was downslope. So some of the things we wanted to address were the breaches in the impoundment dam, stability concerns. The dams hadn't been maintained in over 40 years, so there was large tree growth present on the dams. It was a concern that if one of the trees would fall over, that we might get some stability concerns with the dam and the structure of the dam. So there were a lot of things that kind of drove us towards trying to identify some measures that we could do to really kind of address the ongoing erosion and mitigate that and try to take care of this eyesore in the community. Just some photos to give you some perspective on what the site looked like prior to any of the work. Again, this is AOC 1. This is located down gradient of the flanks of the knob across from Henry Knob Road. And basically, all the material that was up on the knob that was denuded of vegetation was in the process of trying to get down gradient and downstream, and this was the impoundment that was downstream. So every storm event we had, there was transport of tailings from the AOC 5 impoundment down towards Henry Knob Road. There are four culverts that run under Henry Knob Road from AOC 5 to AOC 1 impoundments. So tailings would be transported downstream through those culverts and end up at AOC 1. And this, as you can see, there's some. This is one of the drainage channels from one of the road culverts. Massive amount of erosion that's coming through under the roadway. You can see the site was denuded of vegetation and was an eyesore and an available resource to people to come and use as a disposal area. These black markings, which might be hard to see on the slide, are tires. We found several hundred tires that had been disposed of at the site. And then this last photo for AOC 1 on the bottom, you can't really tell, but this is the terminus of the impoundment, and this is about a 30-foot-high dam that is just covered with large tree growth, and obviously is something that we wanted to take care of from a maintenance perspective to make sure that dam was not going to fail. AOC 2, similar situation, impoundment dam breaches, large erosion rills, misuse of the property. You can see some folks had established what looks like some kind of camp in the woods on this tailings impoundment. And again, this bottom photo is a picture of a couple of the dams. You can't really see them. There's huge tree growth here. This dam was probably about 45 feet high. This bare area here is part of the tailings impoundment at AOC 2. There's some grasses that had grown on it, but the tree growth hadn't really taken root there yet. One of the other tailings impoundments we looked at was AOC 3. Again, this is the former operations area and pyrite storage area. One thing that Jason will point out in his slide deck, in his part of the talk, is the material at AOC 3 was significantly different than materials that we encountered at the other tailings impoundments. This was used as a pyrite storage area, so the material was much more rocky and bony and hard to really break through, whereas the other impoundments were mostly silica sand or silts and clays that had washed downstream. But again, even with this hard material and hard pan at AOC 3, you can see we had tailings breaches. This road right here is Highway 55. This is a utility right-of-way, and this is AOC 3 in the background here. These are tailings that had washed down from AOC 3 into the right-of-way. Another photo of the erosion, massive erosion at AOC 3. This is the drainage channel that leads down to Highway 55 and comes out right here. So you can just see there's just massive transportation of tailings and erosion that's going on at the site that we really needed to address. And this is probably the largest tailings impoundment. Again, you can see a breach in the dam on the upper left photo here. Again, tailings that had washed down from AOC 5 towards Henry Knob Road. And when the culverts that ran from AOC 5 to AOC 1 would clog up, those tailings would back up and then run onto the road. So that was a concern both from just a transport issue and a safety issue during some of these large storm events that Jeff had talked about. And again, the AOC 5 kind of landscape photo, again, you can see the massive erosion and issues that we were facing with AOC 5. So with all this erosion and tailings transport going on, we needed to come up with a quick solution to try to mitigate it in the short term while we kind of planned our long-term strategy. And the one mitigation tool that we came up with that worked very effectively were temporary check dams. And we installed about 50 rock check dams at the AOC 5 area to mitigate the transport of erosion down to AOC 1. Total length of check dams was about 1,100 linear feet. And then we'd have to maintain these check dams on an as-needed basis, and that was typically two times per year. What we would do is clean the check dams out, pull the tailings out from behind the rock check dams, and then just replace the tailings back up onto the impoundments. And again, just some photos on temporary mitigation. You can see some of the check dams we installed. Pretty effective as a temporary mitigation measure. Water would run down, pool up behind it. The fines and the tailings would filter out. The water would run through, and then we'd come in and muck out these back behind the check dams. So all that interim work was part of our long-term strategy, and we worked pretty closely with EPA to try to figure out a remedy that would be applicable for the site in both a cost-effective and technically feasible manner. And we worked with EPA and DHEC quite closely to develop an adaptive management approach. And I won't read the slide, but I think if you look at the graphic on the right hand of the slide, that really kind of does justice to what the adaptive management approach is. It's a plan, do, and evaluate and respond process. And it's an iterative process. And we'll talk a little bit in Jason's presentation a little bit more about the adaptive management approach and how we employed it at the site. But generally, it's those three things, plan, do, and evaluate and respond, that you need to keep in mind. And you have to realize that the first measure you do may not be effective, and the first thing you try may not be effective. But what you try to do is take a lesson away from it, some lessons learned, and then revise that approach and come up with a next step in the remediation. And one thing that allowed us to really move forward with this was a key phrase from the administrative order on consent that allowed us to really focus on interim measures prior to conducting the FS. And again, I won't read the slide, but it's this last statement in the administrative order that really let us kind of work ahead of completing the FS and work to mitigate these kind of erosion problems and erosion and sediment transport problems that were ongoing at the site. And I think with that, I will turn it over to Paul Johnstone from AMEC Foster Wheeler to talk a little bit about the remedial investigation, the groundwater monitoring program, and the groundwater modeling program that we completed for the site.
All right. Good. Thanks, Shep. Thanks, Shep, and good afternoon to everybody. I'm going to talk about the remedial investigation, kind of a summary of the investigation and what we concluded from the investigation. One of the problems we ran into was how to differentiate between acid mine drainage and acid rock drainage. I'll talk a little bit about that. Some monitoring that we did, modeling that we did to further buttress the conclusions we had from the remedial investigation, and then a groundwater monitoring program that we're currently in right now. The RIFS work plan specified that the RI would be conducted in three phases, and there were three individual sampling events identified as steps 1 through 3. As Shep mentioned earlier, that investigation was conducted from 2005 to 2010. Step 1 included background as well as area of concern surface soil sampling, sediment and surface water sampling, and development of a conceptual site model. Step 2 included the initial groundwater investigation along with some additional surface water delineation. And then Step 3 included determining the horizontal extent of groundwater impacts. The final RI report, including human health and baseline ecological risk assessments, was submitted in June of 2011. Shep has talked, or Gene has talked a little bit about the areas of concern. I won't really talk about the impoundments since he pointed those out, but I did want to point out the mine pit pond, which is, let's see, I don't have my green arrow here. There we go. Okay, AOC 4, which is the mine pit pond, and then AOC 6, which are surface water features. Including the South Fork of Crowder's Creek, what we call the West Tributary to the South Fork of Crowder's Creek, which emanates from AOC 1, the East Tributary to the South Fork of Crowder's Creek, which emanates from AOC 2, and then during the RI, we determined another tributary, which is a second-order tributary to Allison Creek that we evaluated down in this area. We also had some random dumping areas, which I think Shep pointed out on some of the of his slides, where we did some sampling. We also took a look at AOC 8, which was a waste rock area on the north side, and then AOC 9, which is a waste rock area on the south side, and then, of course, AOC 10 was a site groundwater. The sampling we did during the RI included surface soil, sampling, surface water and sediment sampling, installation of monitoring wells, piezometers, collecting groundwater samples from the monitoring wells, collecting samples from residential private water supply wells, and then ecological sampling in support of the baseline ecological risk assessment. The analytes that we looked at on the initial group of sampling was volatile organic compounds, semi-volatile organic compounds, polychlorinated biphenyls, cyanide, and metals, obviously. Based on the results of the initial sampling, we didn't detect anything but metals in the samples, so that eliminated the amount of things we had to analyze for and helped us to then tailor our additional investigation as we went forward. Then after the completion of the RI, we did additional environmental sampling, which included both surface and subsurface soil samples. Test pits, we did some whole rock sample analyses, installed additional monitoring wells, piezometers. We kept throughout the process collecting additional residential well samples. And then, as we'll talk about later, we started doing routine groundwater sampling. So what did we learn from the RI? With respect to soils, we found there was really no statistical difference between the background metals in soils that were collected from the mineralized zone. These would be soil samples next to the ore body outcrops, and then a non-mineralized zone, which would be everywhere else that wasn't impacted by the mine. acid-base accounting in paste pH from the AOC surface soil samples indicated a capacity to produce acid mine drainage, or AMD. And then aluminum, iron, and manganese were probably most commonly detected, but the concentrations in the AOCs were not particularly elevated in relation or when compared to the background soils. And we determined that there was no unacceptable risk to human health or the ecological receptors. Sediment, really all we saw in the sediment were metals, and there was no unacceptable risk to human health or the ecological receptors by the sediment. Then the surface water in the mine pit pond, we determined that there was minimal hydraulic connection with the underlying bedrock, and primarily only along the strike of the ore body. So transverse to the ore body, we didn't see much connection to the pond. And that the impact of the pond water results really from acid rock drainage that we'll talk about a little bit later, as opposed to acid mine drainage. The surface water tributaries that we pointed out on a couple of slides ago, we determined that the AMD impacts are associated with leaching from the tailings to groundwater, and that's generally restricted to the headwaters of the tributaries. We found that pH and concentration of the metals generally improve downstream, and there's no unacceptable risk to human health by exposure to the surface water. An ecological condition of concern for surface water was determined to be low pH and acidity. For groundwater, it's important because groundwater is the primary source of potable water in the site area. It's present under water table conditions in both the overburdened soils that are formed by the in-place weathering of the bedrock, which we call saprolite in our neck of the woods, as well as in the fractured bedrock itself. The groundwater in the site area has a relatively low pH, generally less than 7, and may have elevated metals due to the geology as a result of the acid rock drainage. However, the groundwater in the monitoring wells that we installed downgrading from the tailings impoundments do have a very low pH and are impacted by acid mine drainage. Based on the age of the site and the history of the operations, as well as the release mechanisms, the magnitude and the extent of the impacts to groundwater are expected to be stable in the future. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in the groundwater modeling. And the boundary of the groundwater affected by the site appears stable and shouldn't expand, but it's expected to persist. A non-cancer risk to future use of groundwater as a potable water source due to elevated metals existed primarily due to cobalt and manganese. However, that risk is associated with a hypothetical exposure to the highest concentrations of metals that were reported in the site monitoring wells and really doesn't represent risk associated with the current use of groundwater as a potable drinking water supply. A remedial action objective was developed to prevent the use of groundwater that contains concentrations of metals that pose non-cancer risks to human health. Obviously, due to the abundant metals that are present in geological formations in the site area, it's difficult to differentiate between AMD impacted groundwater and naturally occurring groundwater that's been impacted by ARD. So let's talk a little bit about AMD and ARD. As I'm sure everybody knows that's on the call today, AMD is a common environmental impact at former mining sites and occurs where iron sulfide minerals, principally pyrite, are present and exposed to water and oxygen, releasing sulfate, iron, and acidity. A very simplistic overall chemical formula that represents or results in AMD is pyrite plus oxygen plus water yields iron precipitates plus acidity. The acidic waters also promote the weathering of other minerals. So the mining and beneficiation of the ore body resulted in the accumulation of mine residuals consisting of fine-grained tailings and waste rock piles. Fine-grained materials, like tailings, will result in higher oxidation rates simply due to the increased surface areas of the pyrite that's exposed to oxygen and water. And the ability of the tailings to continue to produce acid and leach metals is limited only by the presence and amount of pyrite, soluble salts, oxygen, and the availability of water in the form of infiltrating precipitation. The ABA analysis and the paste pH sampling, as I mentioned earlier, indicated that the tailings are a source of AMD. However, the waste rock is not a significant source of AMD, and it's probably more indicative of ARD. So the similar acid weathering conditions can occur in the absence of mining, and that's commonly called acid rock drainage, or ARD. And that's oxidation of pyrite from the in-place bedrock, most notably between the water table and the land surface. And it's increasingly become a recognized environmental condition at construction sites, transportation corridors, and other areas where bedrock is excavated. Evidence of ARD, including exposed outcrops with weathered sulfide minerals and anomalously elevated metals and stream sediments, are all tools used by the mineral exploration geologist to locate sulfide-bearing mineral deposits. ARD can occur in potable wells that have been installed in sulfide-bearing bedrock when oxygen is introduced through the well installation and subsequent pumping. We've encountered ARD in private wells along the strike of the ore body at mined at Henry Knob, as well as along Pat's Road associated with the strike of an unmined northwestern kyanite quartzite formation that parallels the ore body at Henry Knob. And this is just a blow-up of a geologic map that shows the ore body at Henry's Knob. There's the mine pit pond, and there's the extent of the ore bodies that moves down gradient. And then the wells that have a green circle around them are wells that we've identified as being impacted by acid rock drainage as opposed to acid mine drainage. And then this is Pat's Road here, which parallels Henry Knob Road up here. And again, we see this northwestern kyanite quartzite swarm of outcrop, and again a grouping of wells that show evidence of acid rock drainage. And interestingly, this agricultural pond installed down in this area, which is, you know, in a totally different drainage basin from the mine site itself, has very, very low pH because it's exposed water to the underlying saprolite, which was generated from pyrite bearing bedrock. So the area around Henry Knob has a remarkable diversity of rock formations and mineral resources, and even away from Henry Knob, there's been a lot of mining in the area. It's unusual in the richness and variety of the mineral deposits that these formations contain. And those deposits include, among others, kyanite and manganese, which are obviously at Henry Knob. It's been estimated that the principal deposits in the region contain 40 million tons of rock with 10 to 30% kyanite. In the area, the most significant mining was obviously at Henry Knob, where it was the kyanite was produced with pyrite as a byproduct, as Gene indicated, was stored at AOC3. And in this area of the Carolinas, mining has played a significant role from the 1700s to the present. So the ultimate problem we were faced with as we completed the RI was, well, how do we differentiate between groundwater impacted by acid mine drainage and naturally occurring groundwater that may have elevated concentrations of metals but otherwise no impact from mining operations? And we did this by developing a combination of a geochemical signature represented by stiff diagrams and risk-based screening levels that were developed by the US EPA. Both monitoring wells and residential wells were sampled for these geochemical parameters that could be used to determine if the sample showed impacts from AMD. And the geochemical parameters consisted of major anions, bicarbonate, chloride, and sulfate, major cations, calcium, magnesium, sodium, and potassium, ferrous iron, ferric iron, sulfide, acidity, and total alkalinity. The analyte composition and the anion-cation balances for these geochemical parameters were used to generate the stiff diagrams. So the stiff diagrams can be used to describe and compare geochemical differences in groundwater based on charge balances of the cation and anion species by calculating and plotting equivalent charge concentrations in milliequivalents per liter. So a polygonal shape is created from three parallel horizontal axes that extend on either side of a vertical axis. So there's a vertical zero axis, and then we have your anions on this side and our cations on this side. The geochemical signature of the mine-impacted groundwater, or AMD-impacted groundwater, indicates a charge imbalance that is skewed towards high sulfate concentrations relative to the cations and depleted by carbonate due to the acidity, and that's consistent with the geochemical processes that are responsible for AMD, and it generates this very obvious pennant shape that that we use to identify impacts from AMD. Where the pennant shape was not observed, the groundwater was interpreted to not have been impacted by AMD. So you can see what the difference is between these two types of stiff diagrams. And the patterns on the stiff diagrams are very useful in making a rapid visual comparison of geochemical data and allows discrimination between waters from different sources. So we plotted all the stiff diagrams next to the well locations in the area around Henry Knob. And again, it's kind of difficult to see, but if you look inside this red boundary, which is used to, as a line of demarcation between stiff diagrams that have a definite pennant shape indicative of acid mine drainage, as well as some wells that have a little more cations and are probably indicative of acid rock drainage, and then outside of the demarcation, all of the stiff diagrams show no evidence of high sulfate. So we know that metals were detected in groundwater from the overburden monitoring wells, which, as I mentioned earlier, are in saprolite, bedrock monitoring wells, and the residential water supply wells, most of which were assumed to be installed in the bedrock. And although aluminum, cobalt, and manganese were detected with the most frequency at the site in groundwater, manganese was the most widespread constituent that exceeded the EPA regional screening level in effect at the time of the RI. So we used a concentration contour that was approximately equivalent to the EPA RSL for manganese, and that was used in conjunction with stiff diagrams to develop the extent of AMD impacted groundwater. As we talked about with stiff diagrams, if we had groundwater sample results that exceed the EPA RSL but did not have stiff diagrams indicative of AMD, those were not included within the manganese impacted groundwater concentration contours. In this figure, again, it's difficult to see, but this is actually from the RI, and it shows demonstrates the area of groundwater potentially impacted by the mining operations. The solid red line that you see here defines the boundary of the potentially AMD-impacted groundwater based on the stiff diagrams in combination with the manganese concentrations that are above the USEPA RSL. The dashed line actually represents that contour of the manganese RSL. So the combination of those two was how we defined the extent of groundwater contamination or groundwater potentially impacted by the mine. So we said earlier in the conclusions of the RI that we felt like the groundwater plume or the metals impacted groundwater was stable. It wouldn't impact or wouldn't expand with time. So in support of that, we did a regional three-dimensional flow model using ModFlow with data input, model runs, and output using processing ModFlow employing the MT3E code. And that was used to assess the potential impacts of dissolved metals, obviously cobalt and manganese, on regional groundwater quality in the site and further refine the conceptual site model. The telescope models, which are inside of the regional model, were performed using a three-dimensional reactive transport code called PHT3D. And we used those to simulate future transport of low pH groundwater and evaluate groundwater impact to the surface water bodies. The ARD and AMD was simulated through the oxidation of pyrite, and then subsequent pH reactive transport was determined by site-specific geochemical conditions. And we used the telescope models to evaluate the effectiveness of several remedial alternatives, including monitored natural attenuation, an impermeable cap over the tailings, a vegetative cap over the tailings, and excavation of the tailings with either off-site disposal or on-site disposal into the mine pit pond. These figures are from the regional three-dimensional flow model, and we found that due to high soil water partitioning coefficient, or KD, for cobalt and manganese, we were able to demonstrate that there was no significant plume migration over the 30-year modeling period. The figure on the left is for cobalt, and the upper two figures are overburden, and the lower two are bedrock. initial on the left-hand side and at 30 years on the right-hand side, and you can see that there's basically no difference in the concentrations after 30 years, indicating the plume is stable. Same thing for the manganese, overburden, and bedrock, initial and at 30 years, and again, the concentration contours for manganese are very similar initial and 30 years later. The telescope models were able to demonstrate the pH distribution over the 30-year modeling period for each of the simulated remedial alternatives. Most of the impacts were noted in layer one of the model, which is at a shallow depth and is generally equivalent to the overburden. As you can imagine, coming from a relatively flat area up into the knob, the development of layers and their interrelationship was somewhat trying, and it took a lot of effort to be able to get the model to work, but eventually it worked and worked just fine. So as a result of evaluating the alternatives, we saw really no significant changes in pH for either the monitored natural attenuation alternative or for the impermeable cap alternative. But we did see significant improvement in pH for the vegetative cap as well as the excavation alternatives. However, due to the relatively high cost of the excavation and disposal of the tailings and the increased risk due to vehicular traffic, the installation of the vegetative cover was considered the more feasible alternative. We did do some additional model runs to simulate buffering of the water in the mine pit pond, and that indicated some pH improvement, but really wasn't enough to overcome the acid rock drainage generated from the geology of and surrounding the mine pit pond. This is just, again, the model output from the vegetative cover, initial and 30 years. This is the initial 30 years, the pH. The red is from 2 to 3. The orange is the pH from 3 to 4. Light green, 4 to 5. Green, 5 to 6. And dark green, 6 to 7. AOC1, the headwaters of the West Tributary. AOC5, AOC2, AOC3, and the mine pit pond. So after 30 years, we see really a significant improvement along AOC1 and the headwaters, as well as AOC2, also AOC5, although there is still some impacts from pH 30 years down the road, and that's primarily from acid rock drainage from the mine pit pond. So we implemented a groundwater monitoring program in June of 2015 with the objectives of monitoring the groundwater plume stability in the impacted area, also to monitor surface water concentration trends over time, and then also monitor the effectiveness of treatment systems that were installed as part of a non-time critical removal action. The term of the monitoring was going to be the monitoring would be terminated following the completion of trend analyses on the monitoring points following completion of a baseline sampling event. And once that trend analysis showed that metals concentrations were stable or decreasing, then the monitoring could be terminated. The locations monitored in the program consisted of the bounding wells, which defined the extent of the groundwater impacted by AMD, and included 7 overburden monitoring wells, 6 bedrock monitoring wells, and 8 private water supply wells, then interior wells, which were inside the potentially AMD-impacted groundwater, and those were 9 overburden wells, 5 bedrock monitoring wells, and 40 water supply wells, and then surface water locations at the headwaters of the West Tributary, East Tributary, and Allison Creek Tributary, as well as the mine pit pond. The baseline sampling was all wells and surface water locations quarterly for 2 years, and that baseline was completed in the first quarter of 2017. Following the baseline, the bounding wells and interior wells with metals concentrations below the remedial goals established for the site would be sampled annually, and interior wells with metal concentrations above the remediation goals would be sampled on a semi-annual basis. We did encounter some problems in implementing the program due to lack of access. We had 15 private wells, 3 bounding and 12 interior, that couldn't be sampled due to a lack of access. We were able to finally get access for 13 of the 15 wells in the second and third quarters of 2017. Those wells will be sampled quarterly for 2 years unless they're otherwise abandoned. and then the remaining two wells won't be sampled due to the continued lack of access from the property owners. So the trend analyses we did following the baseline that we just recently completed, we found that the bounding wells had decreased cobalt concentrations in all of the wells that we sampled, and we saw decreasing manganese concentrations in the overburden wells. We also saw decreasing manganese in over half of the bedrock and private wells. However, those wells with the increasing manganese concentrations have a relatively neutral pH, obviously not indicative of AMD. They have stiff diagrams not indicative of AMD, and they're significantly below the remedial goal for manganese, and in many cases below the secondary MCL for manganese. So the indication would be that it's acid rock drainage. In the interior wells, we generally see decreasing trends for both cobalt and manganese, except when we have evidence of AMD impacts, which very often we'll see an increase in both the cobalt and the manganese. And the figures on the bottom are just some representative figures of an overburden well and a bedrock well, showing the concentrations over time with trend analyses, and then the remedial goal options shown as dashed lines just for a point of reference. And I think that covers me.
Okay, great. I think we can take a brief pause here and maybe ask one or two questions that have come in before we wrap up with Jason. So we got a couple questions about some of the contamination and some of the methodology that you were talking about, Paul. And I guess if you could just clarify a little bit more of what the contaminants of concern were for the site. I know it was the acid mine drainage and the acid rock drainage. Was it primarily the pH of the water that was a concern, or were there other contaminants?
Primarily, it was the metals contamination groundwater with pH below a secondary maximum contaminant level, which, of course, is not a health risk issue. And the elevated metals and the low pH, we feel, are in some cases a result of the acid mine drainage generated from the tailings. And in other cases, it's from the acid rock drainage, which occurs naturally.
Right, right. Okay, great. Thanks for clarifying that. And then you had talked about using an acid-based accounting methodology for testing some of the soil samples. Can you describe a little bit about what that is?
That's really outside my area of expertise, and in fact, we had to send the samples up to Canada to have it done. But it generally comes back with a neutralization potential of the sample. So if you have a neutralization potential, the sample has the ability to mitigate or neutralize the acidity, and you don't generate you won't generate acidity is how I understand it.
Okay, great. Thank you for clarifying that. I think in the interest of time, I think we'll move on to Jason and let him do the last part of the presentation.